kind of candy you want. Sweet chocolate, chocolate malt, candy, gumdrops, anything you want. You've come to the right man because I'm the candy man.
Ooh. Who can take a sunrise?
Who can take a sunrise?
Sprinkle it with you.
Sprinkle it with you.
Cover it with chocolate and a miracle or two. The candy man.
The candy man.
Candyman can.
And joining us now is the director of one of the greatest films ever done. It's called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and he's written a great book. This is a wonderful tabletop book, a great present for Christmas for folks out there. It's called Pure Imagination, and director Mel Stewart joins us. Hi, Mel. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Fine when I hear your voice.
It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And Mel's well with the movie. And it's interesting to note that I have two children, 8 and 11, who in the last year and a half have discovered Willy Wonka and now insist on watching it over and over on the big screen. So
that's great. Yeah.
It's a film that is enduring over the generations. You know, parents, grandparents, kids can all watch it together, and it's a wonderful film.
Thanks. When we began to make it, my object was to make a film for adults. I never set out to make a Disney-like film for children. And that's why I put in as much sophistication as I could in the language and the words and the playing of Wonka and the kids so that adults could watch it with the children but get another kick out of it that the children didn't get at the time. And when they grew up, they could look at it in a different light.
Well, the Wonka character is kind of a scary character in my mind.
Yeah, we didn't want to have a nice man. We wanted to have a man who was mercurial. You couldn't quite figure him out. He looked a little bit mad sometimes, and other times he was nice, and it kept you, we hope it kept you on the edge of your seat.
One of the things I think is key in the movie, too, is the music, and Anthony Newley's song Candyman fit in beautifully, huh?
The song is just gorgeous. Actually, Anthony Newley wanted to play it in the picture. He wanted to open the picture by singing The Candyman. And I had quite a fight on my hands because I love the song, but I felt if you saw a big film star or a theater star open the picture, you would lose the reality. And it would become just a star turn. And what I wanted people to believe is in some way, this really might be happening. You don't notice any cars, you don't notice any time or any place. We shot in Munich. I didn't want you to feel there was anything particularly Hollywood about it, if I could, as much as I could within a fantasy. Keep it real.
That's interesting. And of course, that song, it later became a number one hit for Sammy Davis Jr.
Absolutely. It was a great song. The score was marvelous. They were good, Brickus and Newley.
You know, the book itself, the book that it's based on, was a really interesting book in its own. I mean, the book, of course, was called Charlie and Chocolate and the Chocolate Factory. Roald Dahl wrote the book, mm-hmm. And I guess that the interesting thing of the whole thing for all of us who are big fans of this movie is the fact that the reason it got made was of your daughter's suggestion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, this is 30 years ago. My daughter was 11. And she came in and put this book in my hand and said, Daddy, make a movie out of this book. Because a little child doesn't quite understand. It's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the book, and it had great promise. The story was good, but it needed some work. But I thought it could all make it on a screen. And I went to my associate, David Walper, on this firm, and he loved the idea. He never actually read the book. I just told him it was about this man at Chocolate Factory, and he walked over to do something else with the Quaker Oat Company. We were doing a series of documentaries. And while he was there, they said to him, you know, we're thinking of making a chocolate bar. You got something that could tie in? And he said, oh, boy, do I have something. And they told him the story of Willy Wonka as I gave it to him. And they said, let's do it. And that was going to be the greatest tie-in in the history of films, that this would be a picture paid for by Quaker Oats, and they would make a chocolate bar, and we would make the movie. Well, we made the movie, but unfortunately, for whatever reason, after a year of work, they couldn't make a chocolate bar that would stay in the stores on the shelves. It would either melt or go stale. So they got out of the chocolate business, but we had our movie.
And the interesting thing is that recently when I was at a toy store, they were selling Willy Wonka chocolate bars.
Right, but they're made by Nestle.
Isn't that interesting, huh?
Nestle bought the franchise eventually.
They bought it. They bought from Quick Oats.
Bought the idea of being able to make a Wonka bar. And it was just one of those strange things. They just couldn't get it together.
There was one thing about Willy Wonka that I never really understood, and that was the fact that, you know, the golden tickets, there was going to be five winners in the golden tickets.
Right.
But the winner was going to get a chance to get a tour of the factory. Mm-hmm. Why did they go out and have these people buying hundreds of thousands of bars for a tour of the factory?
Well, they also was going, if I'm not mistaken, now I may be, but I thought it was that they were going to get a lifetime supply of chocolate.
Well, that's true. They were.
And I guess people were so entranced by the thing, and greetings to Lucky Finder, and they were going to get a tour of the factory and to go in if they found the ticket, and then somehow they were going to get a lifetime supply of chocolate. And for whatever reason, this is a fantasy, you know.
I know this is.
It was enough for people to want to win the ticket.
Yeah, I never understood the salt.
Yeah, I never understood how a little child always won the ticket, not an adult.
Yeah.
But that's the part of the fantasy. See, we have a rule in Hollywood: you can never film the book. In other words, a book is a book and a film is a film.
Right.
And you need a screenwriter to come in and add the elements that the book might have, or take out elements. For instance, in the original book, there was no villain. There was no Slugworth.
Right.
So there was never a sense of evil hanging around on the outside. We added that.
You need
there was
that.
No Gobstopper contest.
Yeah, you have to have that tension in the film.
Yeah, I mean, Slugworth gave you a sense of tension. He's an evil man. Also, he enabled Charlie to be tested for his honesty.
Right.
Which you didn't have in the book. Charlie, in the book, just wins because he's a nice guy.
Right.
You didn't have the Gobstoppers. You didn't have the fizzy lifting room. There are many elements that you have to add when you make a film. People could read a book and enjoy it, but when it's up there on the screen, it's another kind of experience.
The chocolate bars, that chocolate room, and all these different sets were incredible. That must have been a lot of fun to even put it together. I saw pictures of you standing in there, and it looked like it was overwhelming.
Well, it always is. I mean, what we were doing is there was no picture of a real candy room. There was no picture of the chocolate room, really, that meant anything. And I brought in a wonderful designer called Harper Goff, who did the Fantastic Voyage and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and he just had a fantastic imagination. And the only time we got into a quarrel was when he made a beautiful inventing room where all the pipes were made out of steel and everything else, and I said, that's not like Wonka. Wonka's a little bit mad. So we went out to the junkyards of Munich where we shot the picture and got all parts of automobiles and pipes and put them and made that into the inventing room. In fact, he also built a beautiful office for Wonka, and I didn't think it was mad enough, so I instructed them to cut everything in half. All the furniture was cut in half.
I remember. That was one of its trademarks.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things about the film, too, that I thought really did a real nice job. It's a great film, and from beginning to end, it's something that you can study on how to put together a good film. But one of the things I really enjoyed about it was the fact that it took Charlie and really showed us the impoverished lifestyle that he had. And
if a fairy tale works best when somebody starts from the bottom and wins the big prize. And Roald Dahl had this idea that we kept of having the four grandparents in a bed and Charlie needing to work so hard to, in fact, get just some potatoes to eat with. And I think that worked. I mean, you really felt for Charlie as you didn't feel for the other children who were obviously well off.
Right. And, of course, it was a great tale of morality. Each of the children had some kind of defect. The ones that were in the finals, they all had some kind of weakness that they caved in that cost them, or some kind of dishonesty in their personality.
Well, I think that's one of the things, one of the reasons secretly why children like it. See, I have great faith in kids. And I believe, given choice, they will do the right thing. And I think one of the reasons it caught on for so many years is that deep down, children know that bad is bad and right is right, so they enjoy the bad kids getting their comeuppance.
Yeah, I think you're right. And they're funny, too. I mean,
there you've got it. If you go through it, all their remarks, the kids' remarks, are basically very adult humor. They're filled with adult humor. It's all turns of speech and phrase. There's more Shakespeare in the picture than any kind of picture outside of Shakespeare. It's filled with quotes from famous poets, Ogden Nash and Oscar Wilde. You don't know it really, but because it's just put in as dialogue. But everybody's speaking quite sophisticatedly. with sophisticated speech.
Yeah.
And that's what I think gives the picture its special pleasure. You know, I didn't want it to be simplistic.
Now, where did you find out the little people for the movie?
Well, the little people came from all over Europe. There aren't many little people around these days as performers. And one of the big problems was, in the original book, the 1964 edition, all the Oompa Loompas were in the shape of black pygmies, in the makeup of black pygmies. In other words, the factory was run by black pygmies. And mm-hmm. Some actor friends of mine, African-American friends, came and saw me, and they said, is this picture really going to be with little black people running the factory, like slaves imported from Africa? And I saw their point. Of course, that would be wrong, it would be silly, and it would be tasteless. So what we did was, after about a minute and a half or 2 minutes of thought, I said, how about if we give them orange faces and green hair? How will that be? And everybody said, oh, that's great. And in the later issues of the book, from 1974 on, all the little Oompa Loompas are white.
Huh. So, well, see, we just got a call from Trent Lott. He's very upset that you changed it.
Yeah, well, I think we know which way Trent Lott would like it, but unfortunately I don't. And I just didn't think it was fair, and it wasn't right. And when you think about it, it would really be kind of not in good taste. So what we did, everybody was happy. Everybody loves the look of the Oompa Loompas. And the change that I made it more unique, made these people very special, and they are very popular. I mean, I've been in countries and people have met me and they suddenly break into the Oompa Loompa song. You know, they became part of the uniqueness of the book because of their orange faces and green hair.
The book is incredible, by the way. It's pure imagination, and by Mel Stewart with Josh Young, and fantastic book to buy. It's from L.A. Weekly Press. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the people in the film, the update. And we know poor Jack Albertson's not with us anymore.
Right.
But a lot of the kids, like Charlie, are still around, and they've grown up.
Yeah, everybody came out and you never know what's going to happen later in life. Charlie, Peter Ostrom, decided that he didn't want to act anymore. He got some offers right after the film. A lot of people want him to play roles, but he decided to become a veterinarian. And he's now a veterinarian in up in New York State and does quite well. Mike TV had a little bit of a career, but he went on Paris Theman. He went on to travel around the world by himself with a backpack for 2 years, and then has finally settled down and is a stockbroker with Solomon Smith Barney.
We actually had Denise Nickerson on our show.
Denise Nickerson, who played Violet Beauregard, she ran some nursing homes. She acted for a while. She was very good. She had a nice career for a while, then got out of it and ran nursing homes. And my dear favorite, Veruca, Julie Dawn Cole, who played Veruca so brilliantly, kept her career for quite some time in Britain, worked on a lot of sitcoms, so forth, but now has finally retired. She does voiceovers, and she's got a couple of kids.
We should mention that she's still beautiful as well.
Oh, she's absolutely still stunningly beautiful. Mm. She just grew very, very beautiful. And Augustus Group, he's an engineer somewhere in Munich. We just took him not because he was an actor but he looked the part, and he was very sweet and very pliable, but he never really wanted to be an actor.
What about Rusty Goff?
Rusty Goff is the best. Rusty Goff, oh, we were talking about the Oompa Loompas, where we got them from. So we got the Oompa Loompas from all over Europe. One was from Malta, one was from Turkey, one was from Germany, and a lot of them didn't speak English. So we had quite they were very sweet and very cooperative, but it got confusing sometimes. And I found my final Oompa Loompa, a little person called Rusty Goff in England, who had played Shakespeare on the stage. And I said, he's the man for me. He's going to be the lead Oompa Loompa. And he was. And now all the Oompa Loompas, all little people have died. They don't live that long.
Wow.
And except for Rusty. Rusty's going on. He's married two beautiful, tall, blonde women and is playing in Harry Potter.
So how old is Rusty?
Oh, well, now Rusty would be about... Let's see, he had to be 20 at the time, so it would be, he would have to be at least 55 now.
Wow.
And it's the longevity is a different case with little people.
Yeah. Yeah, when you, this film stands up so well to time. That is one of the things I always thought is just really tough to do. But you made this so that it's generic enough that it can go any time. I mean, 50 years from now, this will still be a classic.
Well, hopefully, they'll still think. I mean, they won't know. It's so important in fantasy when you're trying to be in the modern world that they just can't place you as, oh yeah, this looks like 1970s costumes. I mean, that's the one thing I didn't want to do. I thought that would hurt the longevity of the picture. I went through the book of stills. Warner Brothers allowed me to get a lot of behind-the-scenes stills to put in the book, and they had never printed them before. It's just interesting to look at the people. You see the Oompa Loompas actually without costume.
Right.
For instance, I found that fascinating, when I found that picture. And there's a whole bunch of other pictures like that behind the scenes.
One of the pictures I enjoy here is watching Julie Cole eating the chocolate. And I understand she didn't like chocolate.
Yeah. And she was such a good trooper, but for some reason she disliked chocolate. The kids were so game. Whatever they wanted to do, whatever they had to do, they would do. Even the saddest thing was Violet in that big purple bubble that she was in, because that was made out of two big pieces of plastic that we put her in and then shut them down. It was a great deal of work to do it, and during the day when we were doing her scene, which took a whole day, at lunchtime, we all went to eat, and she couldn't come to eat because she was in the bubble, and to get her out would mean 2 hours back and forth and in and out, so we just left her there with a stagehand. And he fed poor Violet by his spoon, and she could drink some soda from a straw. And he would turn her every once in a while so that the blood wouldn't be going to her head. It was a very strange thing, but she always remembered that she couldn't go to lunch that day because she was imprisoned inside the bubble.
There's an interesting picture of the Oompa Loompas rolling her around the thing. I would assume that wasn't very comfortable for her.
No, it wasn't, and unfortunately, the Oompa Loompas were not that gainly, so they were supposed to roll her out the door as the door opened, but they missed time and time again. The bubble started going off to the side, and she would be banging into the side of the wall until they finally got it right after about a dozen takes. Because it was hard for them. It was a very big bubble, and they were little people, and they were trying to guide it to go out the door, and sometimes it just didn't make it.
Yeah, I can't think of... I'm sorry.
No, well, she earned her price, her pay that day.
I can't think of any better tribute to the movie than the fact that Verica Salt's name is used by a rock group now.
I love that. The Verica Salt group, which was popular for a little while. It sort of just got into the mainstream of... because so many kids had seen it, and the big thing was that it played on television and still does so much. It's always on a cable network somewhere in the United States, almost every week. In fact, it's probably been seen more than most pictures. I mean, a great classic like 8 and a Half by Fellini or Double Indemnity by Billy Wilder has not been seen as much as Willy Wonka, and that's just a fact of life. That I think the thing is that adults enjoy it as much as kids, so they're willing to sit there with the kids and watch it.
I think one of the other things that helps it a lot too is the new DVDs and the fact that people have digital TVs and it looks incredible in digital with all the colors and everything.
Yeah, they've redone the track and the colors. It's amazing how they can restore these things to the original. And I'm very happy because what happens with film after a while, it depends on how many years, but it begins to go. You can't help it. Whereas with digital numbers, 10101010, it's going to last for a much longer time.
What kind of contributions did Stan and Dave make to this along with you?
Pardon me?
Stan and Dave?
Yeah. Well, Stan Margulies was the producer, and I was the director, and Dave Orpel was the executive producer. Dave's job, and he did it magnificently, was to get the funding and to help with the casting and so forth. But the day-by-day problems were solved every day by Stan Margulies, the producer. He just, you can't imagine the amount of problems that you have every day. That where's the actors, where's the makeup, where's the river, is the river going the right way, and is the boat ready? And that's a great producer, a great line producer like Stan Margulies takes care of the problems that you don't want to think about. And that was Stan's job. In other words, it's tough enough just doing the creative side. You need somebody who's going to take care of the day-by-day things, else the picture doesn't make it. I mean, you just don't get through the day. And you begin using your energy in worrying about whether the makeup man arrived on time. That's not the director's job.
Right.
And he was wonderful at that. He just knew how to do it, and he was very quiet and calm. And he brought a sense of peace to the set that was wonderful.
As you look back on the film now and watch it, is there anything at all you would have done differently?
Of something very subtle that most people wouldn't notice. No, I am happy with everything in the picture except I tried one joke, musical joke, that didn't work. And I left it in the picture. And probably I shouldn't have, but for whatever reason I did.
Which musical joke is that?
I grew up as a musician, and that was my first love. I wanted to be a composer, and I was very familiar with music and so forth. And when Mr. Wonka plays the little piano to open the door to the factory, he had to play a little melody so that the door would open. And obviously, as director, the choice is mine as to what the melody would be. So I gave him the melody to the overture to The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. Goes dee-da-dee-da-dum, dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-dum. And then the woman says Rachmaninoff for the joke, and then the door opens. Well, the only problem is, since I was a musician and so forth, I had a little bit more experience, I put in the overture of The Marriage of Figaro, which most people do not know. So when she says Rachmaninoff, the joke doesn't work because most people don't know what she's talking about. They might think it's Rachmaninoff.
Right.
And I realized later, after I had shot the scene and was over, I should have played Bum 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 Bum, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Right, because everybody knows.
Everybody
that
would have got the joke on Rachmaninoff.
Right.
Because obviously they would have known it's not Rachmaninoff.
Right.
But it was done, it was shot, and I let it in. But I should have done it the other way. So the people who know the Mozart overture will get the joke, but I think that's a very, very, very small part of the population.
Do you think there'd be any interest at all in a follow-up movie with showing the little guy in charge?
Now, there's there's been some talk at Warner Brothers. In fact, they've gone ahead with it of remaking the movie.
Yeah.
Why, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't understand the purpose of it. They've got their DVD, and it keeps going and going and going. But they've hired two teams to try and redo it, and both of them stopped. They gave up after a while.
Why would I don't know. I never understand Hollywood when they do that. If you're going to redo a film, you redo one that has problems and it wasn't very good, not one that has everything that goes beautiful with it.
I know. I mean, remember they tried to redo Psycho?
Exactly.
Totally pointless. Lost all their money.
Exactly.
Sabrina. I mean, if a picture's got its own particular thing, and I'm not saying, you know, this is the greatest picture in the world, but it's got its own bag, it's in its own thing, why they would want to redo it is something I agreed. How about that? Is that a good word?
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
It's like, and not only that, you know, Mel, it's also a lack of creative juices now in Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, you would think, isn't there one other story in the whole cosmos that they could possibly spend their money on? Mm-hmm. But I guess they get greedy and they feel if they remake it again, people come to see it again. But I just don't think that works all the time. I guess it works sometime, but, you know, there's nothing... Since there's nothing I can do about it, I just, every time I hear these stories, I just let them go by. But I do know, two very gifted teams have tried it, and for whatever reason, I have no idea, they just abandoned the project twice. But I'm sure they'll go and try a third time.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to remind folks that the book is available. It's a great gift, and if you love the movie, and I do, I'm going to cherish this book. It's called Pure Imagination, The Making of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It's by director Mel Stewart, who joins us right now, and Josh Young as well, and it's available from LA Weekly Books for St. Martin's Press. It's an excellent, excellent book. You know, now with TV... I'll change the subject for a second.
Mm-hmm, sure.
TV, reality TV seems to be like one of the biggest things there is now. Everything's reality TV.
Mm-hmm.
You actually were one of the pioneers of that with the Ripley's Believe It or Not show.
Right. About 1982 through 86, I did Ripley's Believe It or Not with Jack Palance. And it was, I guess, a little bit ahead of its time. And it was all about real life. And it was very entertaining. And I had a wonderful time doing that. I've been fortunate. I've been able to do both documentaries and reality and do features and long-form television. I just sort of jump back and forth.
Are you still working right now?
Oh, yeah.
So what are you doing?
I'm doing a series now on living American poets. I'm doing a series about famous poets today and profiles of them. And I just did another picture about 20 memorable photographs in the 20th century for the Trio Channel. So I keep working. I don't know what else to do. I don't like to play golf, so I guess I'm going to have to keep working until I go to the great beyond.
Now, do you have any children, Mel?
Pardon? Yeah, I've got three children, and my daughter brought the book to me. My son, Peter, was Winkleman in the picture.
Oh.
And I told him, I don't want to hear anything about your interpretation. I'm going to tell you how to read it, but just do it the way I want. He was marvelous.
Uh-huh.
And my youngest son, Andrew, is the literary agent that put the whole deal together.
So are there any of them
book,
now?
With St. Martin's.
Are they in showbiz now?
Oh, yeah. Well, my daughter has become... I just got lucky. My daughter became a very, very famous interior decorator, one of the major ones in the United States. And my eldest son, Peter... is now the biggest American producer of television in London. He's got a series on called Eurotrash that's been on for 4 years.
What?
And my youngest son is a successful literary agent. Well, do you know why I think they turn out good? I brought them up just like Mr. Wonka would.
There you go. There you
and
go.
And he knows the right way to bring up children.
With pure imagination.
Pure imagination and a lot of discipline.
And morality.
Right, and morality.
The book, Pure Imagination, it's available right now. Go get it to your bookstore and get it. And Mel, it's a real pleasure to talk to you and to thank you for all the entertainment you've given all of us.
Right, and thank you. It's been a delight talking to you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.